hear ye. All persons having business with the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, will now draw near. Give your attention, and you will be heard. Please be seated.
Thank you, and good morning. The Court of Appeals is very pleased to be sitting in the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands this morning as part of a celebration of a great event in the history of the courts of this Commonwealth. And we are pleased to be in this courtroom to hear our cases. To my right, your left, is Judge Ted Goodwin of Sisters, Oregon, and Pasadena, California, who is a former chief judge of our court. To my left, your right, is Judge Clifford Wallace of San Diego, who is also a former chief judge of this court. And I am Mary Schroeder from Phoenix, Arizona, and I am presently the Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. And we are going to hear the cases in the order that they are listed. We noticed that the first case has been allotted 10 minutes per side. We want to advise counsel that we will not strictly enforce those time limits because they are quite short, and we appreciate that fact. So, with that, we will proceed to hear the case of Santos versus the people of the territory of Guam. Mr. Highsmith, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. We have alleged four separate grounds for reversal of the conviction in this case. The first one being the illegal interrogation and statements obtained by the Guam Police Department in violation of Miranda and related precedents. The second being the trial court's refusal to appoint a forensic pathologist. Third being unfavorable pretrial publicity, which was very, very pervasive and harmful to the defendant in this case. And the fourth, the failure to give an informer instruction in regard to the testimony of Joey Arnez, a nephew of the decedent. To begin with the first argument, the defendant was held for 19 and a half hours from the early morning hours of September the 4th until that evening, never given his Miranda warnings, despite being interrogated.
How long was that? Was at the Guam, at the Agana precinct?
It was at Tijan, which is just...
I understand. How long? You didn't understand my question.
Okay.
He first went to the Agana precinct. How long was he at the Agana precinct?
I don't. That I don't know.
Do you contend that that the Fourth Amendment was violated at the Agana precinct?
I believe he was seized without probable cause.
Well, that isn't the point. He was asked to come down and assist the police in finding a missing 11-year-old boy who was the daughter of the woman with whom he was living.
Yes.
And he said he would, and he came down, and he said, "It's okay. I didn't have anything else I was doing. I'm happy to help out." Are you indicating that during the time he was at the precinct in Agana, that he was in custody?
Well, he was held 19 and a half hours altogether.
I'm just focusing you on Agana, not Tijan. Just tell me about Agana.
I believe that. No.
Okay.
That it began voluntarily.
Okay. So at the time he's at Agana, he signs a 9-page statement during the time he's not in custody. And this has to do essentially with finding the young lad. At least that's what they're saying. And the other family are there, but in a different part of the police station. And then he goes to Tijan. Let's grant then that that particular stay violated his Fourth Amendment rights. If we do that, what was there in the nine-page statement and the discussions he held with the police officers at the Agana precinct, which was already given to them and merely repeated at Tinian?
The problem here is we can't say when he made that transference from consensual to non-consensual. I mean, by 7 o'clock in the morning, he had asked to go home. And
that was in Tinian. But they took him up there to check his alibi. Now, I've already granted you for purpose of this question that that was custodial and it was a violation of his Fourth Amendment. My question goes to how much prejudice there is. If during a non-custodial interrogation at Agana that he's already said things, then it seems to me that there would be an argument that it was non-prejudicial that he just repeated them when he was at a place he should have had his Miranda rights. So I'm asking you to identify for me the statements that were made in Agana, which you indicate was at least at the beginning non-custodial.
I would have to say that he was. This was in the early morning hours. I don't recall exactly how much time elapsed while he was at Hagatnya before being taken up to Tijan. Well,
can you help me with this? What exactly were the statements that you claim were procured in violation of his constitutional rights? What is it that he said?
Well, this initial statement, he said that he had driven to Petey with his nephew, Joey Arnaz, who was a conservation officer. And that proved to be very incriminating because Arnaz later contradicted that statement, said, no, I wasn't there, I didn't go with him. And the mother, although her testimony was shaky, testified at trial that she had seen the young boy in the truck with him when he made this drive. Mm-hmm. So it looks very incriminating because he supposedly fabricated this story and asked Joey Arnaz to corroborate it, which eventually Arnaz refused to do. And in fact told the police that he had been asked by the defendant to corroborate this fabrication.
Was there anything else in the nine-page statement that you challenged?
I think that's the salient point.
What? Yeah, and that's the problem we're having. We have no record that we couldn't go read. There was nothing in the excerpt of records that we could read. And, of course, our court rules provide that if counsel is going to rely on something, we ought to have it in front of us. And I don't know how we're going to solve these cases. We're working with Guam now to see when they'll be relieved from duty with the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court isn't going to hear cases without a record. So we're sort of left at drift. But tell me then, assuming that the statements made in Ghana, at the Agana precinct, were consensual, and that the ones in Tinian were non-consensual custodial, what was said in that custodial context that you claim was a violation and prejudicial to your client? Violation and prejudicial to your client.
I think the point we just discussed, Your Honor.
So that's the sum and substance of it, regardless
that,
of where.
That would
it
be the
inculpatory information.
But it was in
a
Yes.
And then what was said after Tinian, in which at least the prosecution says he repeated his statements?
After Tijan?
Yes.
Well, the interrogation on the 13th and 14th, he was seized without a warrant, taken back to Tijan after what we maintain was physical abuse by the police.
Right.
Made another statement.
And then he did the warrant. He did the Miranda statement.
Yes.
And what happened there that the prosecution says that anything that occurred earlier is repeated afterwards by him? Did he repeat once more that he drove his cousin?
Yes.
Okay.
But he added to that a very inculpatory statement that he had burned, admitting that he had burned materials in this pit up in Dedede. And that was, of course, very, very damning because the forensic pathologist examined what he found in that pit and determined that it was the remains of a young boy.
Yeah.
So even though
remains
he was attempting...
A young boy.
Or a young person.
Young person.
Yeah, and putting himself at the scene of the burning like that was very, very...
Did anything else put him at the scene of the burning?
There was testimony from neighbors that they saw him burning something in the pit. Not that they saw what he burned. But presumably that was all obtained partly as a result of his admission that he had burned something there.
You mean they talked to the neighbors after
yes.
he said that?
Yes.
Why were they asking him about it then?
Well, I assume they wanted corroboration of that he was there, that he burned things, and so forth. I'm not sure where the court's going.
Had they already discovered the bones?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think those neighbors were interviewed until long after the initial investigation. The interrogation on the 14th was done without a warrant. A pretextual search warrant was executed on the premises. One of the officers admitted in his testimony that the defendant was the real target of the raid. He was handcuffed, arrested, kicked. That cannot be sanitized with a Miranda waiver. Statements made during an illegal detention are inadmissible. And as far as the fruit of the poisonous tree argument goes, in Volume 3, pages 54 to 55 of the transcripts, Officer Carbolito testified that they needed the second interrogation to clarify discrepancies in his earlier statements. I should have had that in my brief. I'm sorry for not doing it. But going back over the transcripts, as the court ordered us to do, brought that to my attention.
So, do we have CD-ROMs here of the...
I believe opposing
of
counsel
the entire
has
transcript.
Okay.
Before you run out of time, I'd like to hear your theory of why it was prejudicial not to employ a forensic expert. What would your forensic expert have proved if you had employed one?
The problem we have on Guam is there's really only one forensic pathologist. He works for the government, and he works hand in glove with the prosecution on these cases. And,
well, they always do. Whether you're in Guam or some other venue. But the question is, what would your, if you'd had somebody flown over from somewhere where they have contract people,
yes.
What would this expert have done for your case that you couldn't have done and didn't do on cross-examination of the government plan?
Well, he might have raised doubts about whether this was the remains of a young person, whether it was some other kind of bones. I'd like to point out the bones in question were only 2 pounds. It just seems very, very suspect that Dr. Espinola could render a definitive opinion on that point.
Well, haven't explained to me how that you could have brought Johnny Cochran's expert over from Los Angeles, and what would he have said? Would he have said these are not human bones? How do we know that?
I can't what make that representation. I mean, my client testified that he was burning dog bones in the pit. And without someone else's an expert opinion, I can't quite make the representation you're asking me if I can make. But it would be good to have someone else who could look at the same material and see if his conclusion is the
same. Well, when did your client come up with the story that he was burning dog remains? Most people give a dog, if they care about the dog, they give him some kind of a burial. But when he came up with the story that he was burning up a dead dog, was that at the Tijon interrogation or earlier?
It would have been at the September 14th interrogation in Tijon.
So what was incriminating in that testimony was the fact that he was probably lying about what he was doing at that fire pit, not what kind of bones they were. I mean, a forensic expert couldn't have helped you on that unless he said they were dog bones.
Possibly.
Well, I'm trying to get at the prejudice. In order to, in this kind of a case where you're bringing an appeal from in the form of a habeas type appeal, raising federal constitutional questions, you have to show that if an error was made in a discretionary call like appointing a forensic expert, you have to show that it prejudiced the client to the extent of denying him a fair trial. So that's what I'm hoping you'll tell us.
Well, without an expert opinion to combat Dr. Espinola's opinion.
I guess the problem is that we're here on habeas?
No, we're in certiorari.
We're in cert, so we're directly reviewing. Okay. That's what I thought. So you're telling us that there's nothing in this record. Now, if your client is correct and they were really dog bones, theoretically, the time to argue that you were denied due process because there was no expert appointed was after you have somebody find out that they really were dog bones file a habeas petition, I suppose. I mean, theoretically, isn't that right?
I understand the point. What you're saying is you have to go outside the record.
You have to demonstrate that the trial judge abused his discretion in failing to grant you the expert, and it's very difficult on the record we have before us to show that, because you point out, use the term might, it might have. But that doesn't show he abused his discretion or that it was any prejudice. So we're having difficulty on direct review to see how we could reverse based upon abuse of discretion standard.
Okay. You've used your time. We'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal anyway. If you'd like to say anything in closing, or you may reserve some time.
I'll reserve.
All right. Thank you. We'll give you two minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Hear from the people of the territory of Guam.
And Keith, the government. Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Our first argument, of course, is that the Supreme Court erred when it found that the initial statements were taken in a custodial setting, and we went to great lengths to show that there was no custody at that initial interview.
When you say initial interview, you worked with the Agana precinct?
I have, in the brief, treated it as one interview, but yeah, particularly the Agena interview was not.
Convenience me. I've been treating it as two. I assume you would say when he said, "I'm happy to help out. I've got plenty of time. It's my girlfriend's son," that was consensual, and that the 9-page statement was consensual, and he wasn't in custody. But then you take the second step where he's transferred to Tijon, is that how it's pronounced? And at that time, he's taken up there, not according to the record, to help finding the son, boy, but to verify his alibi. So the police are in a different mode. They've now focused on him. They now believe, according to the record, at least some of the police officers believed, that there had been foul play, and this was the number one suspect. And he's taken up there for 19 hours and questioned. And then even at one point, he says, I want to go home. And they say, no, you can't go home. You have to talk to two more police officers. And he doesn't go home until 2 hours later. Now, is it really the position of Wong that that was non-custodial?
We can break it down into three. There were, at 7:50 p.m., he said, I want to go home and take a shower. But the transcript reveals that it is not that he was prevented from going home, but that he acquiesced to later statements. Officer Hertzlet testified that I walked out, and I believe that Officers Galletto and Cruz approached me because they were in the hallway, and they asked to speak to him. And I said, well, it's up to you. He wants to go. So I believe they just entered in on him. That's what Officer Hertzlet said.
Where was the point, though, with the testimony where the police officer said you can't go until two more police officers interview you?
I think that the transcript shows that it was more, you know, we'd like to interview you. Regardless of that, the government didn't use anything that happened between 7:50 p.m. and 9:30 when he got home. None of that was used in the conviction of him in any event. So,
what was used of the Tinian discussions at all in this case?
It's our theory that the statement was introduced into evidence, that statement that was taken at the Ganya precinct. The only evidence that was used from Tijin was used as impeachment. It was used simply to show the non-credibility of the defendant because his statements were later proven to be untrue, as you know. So the only statement used in trial as inculpatory was the statement taken at the Ganya precinct.
I understand the Supreme Court thinks there's a difference between inculpatory and non-inculpatory. I haven't completely agreed with that yet. My mind is open. But let's not limit it. What statements were taken up there and used in the trial?
I don't believe that. In Tijin, there were no statements used.
None. So the only statements that were used in third, fourth, were ones that came out of the Agana precinct?
The only written statement.
No, I didn't say written. I
said
any
statement. Yes, the only statement. Yes.
So, and you did not use any of them in Tinian?
Not the statements on the 4th of September. That's correct.
Wait a minute. At the second part of the interrogation at Tinian, none of those were used.
That's correct.
Okay. We didn't have a record. I didn't know.
Where was the statement taken that contained his failed alibi, the alibi that his nephew was with him and that was proven later, was after testified later, was false?
That was taken at Agana, first thing in the morning.
When he was not in custody.
That's right. And I think he may have repeated that on September 13th when he was an official suspect. But it's our position that he'd waived his Miranda rights by then. There's been no effective attack, as the Supreme Court held. There's been no effective attack on those later waiver of the Miranda warnings.
Well, if his statement at the Agana precinct was not in a custodial interrogation, it doesn't matter whether he waived his Miranda rights, does it? If it was not custodial, they're looking for a missing child. He volunteers to help them. He gives them a phony alibi statement. It turns out later that the jury starts to disbelieve him when they find out that he gave this phony alibi statement. Then he comes up with this phony story about burning a dead dog. And the jury isn't going to buy that either. These are all incriminating. But that dog burning story didn't come out in the Agana precinct.
Oh, no.
That was much later.
Exactly. The Agana precinct story happened before he even burned the body. He still had the body stored at the Petey, at the auto shop in Petey at the time he was giving the bullet. Now he had just finished transporting it up to Dedido, and he had not burned it yet. The
This was all happening while he was busy getting ready to dispose of the money.
So his first custodial interrogation was that 13 hours or so that he was at the other person at the job.
Yes. Well, we don't contend it was custodial, but the Supreme Court found that it
was.
Well,
they said it was, and they said it was error, and then they said it was harmless error.
And we agree with that, too, because everything that he said that was found later to be false, or everything that he said in general, was later found from an independent source. And we think that the Supreme Court was right in applying the independent source doctrine.
But you don't need to get to an independent source doctrine if the original statement's okay. So you're buying more of a burden than you may have to.
Okay.
And as I understand it, you did use statements of the September 13, 14, and September 16, but in those, it's positioned the government that he was given a Miranda statement and it's a valid Miranda statement.
Yes, and the Supreme Court found that no effective attack on those Miranda statements had been launched. He argues now that he was coerced, but there's no evidence of coercion. There were no cuffs after the raid was completed. The warrants were not pretextual. They were actually, the record reveals that there was a warrant to look for evidence on the murder of Hermes Santos. That's in Officer Hertzlet's testimony in the trial.
One of the officers testified that he was the target of the raid. Now, I had assumed reading the briefs that he's just in with a relative at the wrong time, and the relative's place got busted, and everybody sitting there is going to get thrown on the floor and cuffed. But what about the statement of a police officer that he was really the target of that raid?
And in fact, the warrants and the affidavits in support of the warrants didn't make it into the record. But Officer Hertzler did testify that, in fact, two warrants were being executed that morning. One warrant was to look for evidence in the stabbing of Hermes Santos. The other warrant being simultaneously executed was to look for drug paraphernalia that the brother had. And that's in Officer Hertzler's testimony.
So your position is either way, by the time he got to the police headquarters, he was fully given his Miranda rights and voluntarily waived them, regardless of what happened before?
Regardless of what happened, because if you read the transcript, he had still adopted that, the helpful, outwardly helpful persona. He was not cuffed. He was taken to the hospital and given nothing more than ibuprofen. The record shows that. And so there was nothing that could have affected his volition and that affected those statements.
Could I ask about the publicity? The appellant's counsel made quite a point about the need for a change of venue, and I wonder if you could help us understand, has the territorial court ever granted a change of venue to take the case off island if there's publicity in the local media?
No, and this, I think, is probably the most interesting issue on appeal. And even the Supreme Court noted it in footnote 13 that, and in fact, it would be our position, if granted, that there is no court that could properly exercise jurisdiction over this. And this is an interesting Guam issue, because what it is an offense against the territory of Guam, and what court properly has jurisdiction? Change of venue often takes place under a statute in California. Now, there is authority that you can grant a change of venue even where there's no statute. So I'm not persuaded that wouldn't be an impediment. But what court could be forced to accept jurisdiction? And the government would also like to offer a unique historical case that I found involving Oklahoma when it was a territory. And that's the case of Mahaffey versus Territory, found it.
That's right, we can find it.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. In connection with the change of venue, is it really a matter of the court, or is it a matter of the location? I'm sort of thinking of the location. There's one Superior Court of Guam. How many places does it sit in Agana? There is there any courtroom, any place else in Guam?
One was once built in Tumon to house a large commercial case, and the parties had to
finances the land, but no, there's a,
no.
And in fact, it's, isn't it a right to a fair jury?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the jury pool. That,
it's
yeah.
the jury pool.
It's island-wide.
Yes.
It's jury pool.
It's island-wide. There's nowhere else to get there.
BDN island-wide.
Absolutely, in KUAN.
And they were fascinated by this story in their stages and had lots of publicity. But that the trial, well, what was the time delay between the time of the crime and the time of the trial?
Crime took place over Labor Day weekend in 1999. The trial was in April and May of 2000. So it was about
and the
six,
trial
seven,
court
months.
Found and the Supreme Court agreed with it that the, or that the heat had boiled down and the publicity had not was not a continuous stream of publicity during that interim.
That there
that,
was,
is that correct?
Yes, that there was that there a fair and impartial jury could have been found.
Is there any other place in the United States, their territories, that has a similar situation? I mean, can it be?
I was thinking of Washington D.C., but I was only able to find federal cases in Washington D.C. And on the federal level, it's very different.
Yeah.
And I didn't find this case in Washington D.C. on a local level. But like I say, that this Oklahoma case says, in any event, that the Sixth Amendment right to the does not apply to was not meant to apply to territory. So that's another very interesting issue. That if we had gotten to the change of venue, we would have argued that there's nowhere for it to go, and that the Sixth Amendment right wouldn't have applied to the territories in any event.
In the process of this motion for change of venue, did the defendant waive his right to be tried by a jury of his peers?
I don't believe so. I think that
if you transferred it to San Diego for trial, the first argument on appeal would be, I wasn't tried by a jury of my peers.
Yeah.
And I just wondered whether or not that issue came up and whether the defendant waived it.
It didn't. And the other issue is how the San Diego court would have to accept it. Just, I mean, there's no statutory authority under which they could try this case in any event. The Supreme Court was, you'll note that they were frustrated that we didn't get to these issues. Interesting, but in any event, this case wasn't the right case to test them on, and we certainly think they were correct about that. I wanted to point out with respect to the informer instruction that we're relying on the case authority that we used in our brief that as long as you give other instructions regarding credibility of witnesses, and we did give instruction 4D and instruction 4I, and of course all of Joy Arnaz's testimony was corroborated, except as defendant pointed out, the testimony about the alibi, but that wasn't direct evidence, that wasn't in the chain of guilt that Santos established. So, and we would also point out that as to declining to allow him to spend public funds to allow him to hire a forensic pathologist, the law of Guam allowed him to go hire his own, and in fact, since, as the panel correctly noted, collateral review is available, it is his option to get funds to examine those bones even now. But at the time, there was no evidence in the record that they were anything but human bones. So I think that the Supreme Court did not err when it upheld the finding of the Superior Court.
I have one question. Do we now have the total record on CD-ROM?
You have the transcripts. I'm sorry.
I mean the
say,
transcript.
The
yes,
exhibits.
That's what I have in mind.
I'm sorry to say that the exhibits are still.
But that we the transcript.
We do have the transcript on.
To. I haven't looked at them myself.
On CD-ROM, and
on
that
CD-ROM.
Is where now. With
that
the,
is with the District Court of the CNMI.
Okay.
And
then the only other thing we have, of course, is finding it in there, and these documents that both parties have filed will lead us to that, we hope.
Yes.
Yes. And if you didn't, we'll let you know so you can try it over.
Yes.
Then the other thing is the statements that were signed, are they in the, they are not in the excerpt. I wondered if we have copies of those, especially
right.
The one that was signed, the initial one.
Sure, right. I think this is a problem because I did ask the Supreme Court for exhibits, and they reported that they actually never had physical custody of them. When I went to the Superior Court and asked for the transcript, as you know, they said that they mistakenly thought the case was over and they just wrote the transcript. And so I didn't dare ask about the exhibits. I have full copies, I imagine counsel does, but we have a copy of all the exhibits.
If you have any trouble representing the government of Guam to get the exhibits, which were the statements that he signed, if you'll let us know, I'm sure we can enter an order. We have to get this straightened out. We have to have the materials if we're going to properly review Supreme Court of opinion. So if you could, if you have a problem with that within 2 weeks, would you let us know? Otherwise, we'll expect that the statements can be sent to the clerk of our court in San Francisco.
Would a supplemental excerpts of record by both parties suffice?
Anything you want to do is fine. We just want the statements.
Yeah, I believe that those written statements are critical to this case.
And we do, too.
Copies of them. I will conclude by just saying that I really think the prosecutor put on a powerful and convincing case of circumstantial evidence in this case. The jury was permitted to and then did infer that this defendant, Anthony Santos, murdered, then hid, then burned the body of Hermes Santos. So we ask this court to reverse the initial finding of custody to the effect that we don't believe it was custodial, but otherwise we're simply asking for all the convictions to be affirmed. Thank you.
May it please the court. Thank you for the rebuttal time. The court asked if there were any other jurisdictions with similar problems. I would point out that the Virgin Islands is somewhat similar. There is a case cited in my opening brief, El Vocero de Puerto Rico, which discusses this problem in regard to Puerto Rico rather extensively. It didn't result in a reversal, but it did go into and it's a United States Supreme Court case. I would point out that there is only one place where the Superior Court sits. The entire island of Guam is only 32 miles long. The publicity was island-wide. I would have to say that in response to another question, that the defendant's moving to have the case tried in another jurisdiction would have to be deemed a waiver in some way of his right to be tried by citizens and residents of Guam. As for the testimony of Joey Arnaiz, it is not all corroborated. Joey Arnaiz, there was a third person in the van when they drove the body, supposedly, up to Dedido or Jigo. That person owned the van. He just let them use it. He had no idea what was in it. That was Anthony Concepcion. Also, there were parts of his testimony that were not corroborated, such as the request by the defendant to corroborate a phony alibi. There was a statement made by the defendant to Mr. Arnaiz, who asked him, well, if you didn't... if you had a problem with Daisy, why didn't you kill Daisy instead of Daisy's son? The defendant supposedly replied, because I don't care, using an obscenity. And Mr. Arnaiz's testimony is inherently problematic, fraught with difficulty, because he was held by the police 36 hours, made things up, admitted making things up. He was definitely an informer.
Let me ask you a question there. We usually think of informers as people that are paid by the police to go and ingratiate themselves with the target defendant. I didn't see anything in the record that he's an informer. I understand he's a cooperating witness and it didn't help your client any. But what was there in the record that indicate he's an informer? That is, that for some remuneration of some type, he has been placed there by the police to get information.
Well, he had nothing like that. He did testify pursuant to a plea agreement. He pled guilty to hindering apprehension for his role in taking the body up to Dededo and received 2 years probation. He received that benefit. Also, he was hoping to keep his job in law enforcement, which is going to be very hard.
Was that brought out at cross-examination?
Yes.
Let me ask you another question. Counsel for Guam said that none of the statements taken in Tinian on September 3-4 were ever put into evidence. Is that your understanding, too?
No, not at all.
What statements were taken in Tinian September 3-4 that were put into evidence?
The written statement and additional details that came out orally that were not in the written statement, little things.
Like?
I'm trying to remember.
Well, where do we find those?
Excuse me?
Where do we find those?
Those would be in the testimony. If you look at the material that we submitted,
okay,
then it will be... I think I did a fairly thorough job of outlining where the statements are.
Okay.
So you disagree with your adversary on that issue?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I would like to point out that the later Tijan statements on the 13th and the 14th were tape recorded. The tapes were played into evidence. That, too, is noted in the material that I submitted. Of course.
Okay, I think that you've used your time.
Okay. I want to thank the panel very much.
The court will order this matter submitted for decision with the understanding that the parties are to file copies of the written statements with the court in San Francisco within 2 weeks of today's argument. Is that acceptable? Thank you. All right, we'll proceed to hear the next case for argument, Sagana versus Tenorio.